From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, we'll learn more about the Democratic National Convention and how it hopes to represent Milwaukee. Then Milwaukee Magazine offers its tips on staying happy and healthy through the winter season.
One of the ways to survive winter just in general is to develop a hobby that makes you want to go outside, because you can't spend the whole winter inside.
And Milwaukee writer Nick Petrie is back with Book 5 in his Peter Ash series. Petrie says he sets himself a challenge in every book.
Part of the assignment for this one was to put Peter, is to really sort of isolate him and to make him as miserable as I possibly could, to see how deep he could dig and how much trouble he could get into and get out of.
Lake Effect comes your way next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North. As we inch closer to the 2020 Democratic National Convention, Milwaukeeans have been eager to learn more about what the event will mean for the city. On Tuesday, hundreds of people from media outlets around the globe descended on the city for a day of logistics planning and presentations held by the DNC committee. WUWM reporters Mayon Silver and Angelina Mosier-Salazar were there, and they spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about the event.
Members of the media came in on Monday evening for a reception. This was hosted at Discovery World up on the third floor that had this beautiful view of the city. The reception was opened up by a Native American drumming and dance, which was a homage to the Native American rich cultural roots that we have here in Milwaukee. There were also speeches by Mayor Tom Barrett and U.S. Congresswoman Gwen Moore. But essentially, this wasn't an informational session. This was just wining and dining and welcome members of the media to Milwaukee. And Mayan, I know that you got the opinions of some members of the media at the reception.
Yeah, I spoke with David Mark. He's a reporter from D.C., and he says he was at the reception.
Had some excellent trout, which was sautéed with mushrooms. Did not have the cheese curds, but did have the beef tartare, which was excellent.
So, yeah, the events, I think, on the whole, seemed to be flowing well. It was logistics people. It was some reporters. It was people from big media companies from all over the country. And Milwaukee really wanted to put its good foot out. So from the event, reception seemed to flow pretty well.
I could see on Twitter there were a lot of different cream puff takes that got a little heated. And it seemed like a big part of the event, as you mentioned, was really showing off Milwaukee to the rest of the world. So what all happened on Tuesday?
All right. So the following day, there was a bright and early start with breakfast. But this mostly was a walkthrough of the Pfizer Forum, essentially like where the DNC is going to take place. And there were speeches by Governor Tony Evers and Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes, also the head of the DNC, the CEO, Joe Solomonese. And after this logistic walkthrough, members of the media were then shuttled over to the Wisconsin Center. And it was here at informational breakout sessions that members of the media were presented with the nitty-gritty of, you know, Wisconsin politics and people and culture. And Mayan, I know that you have great notes from an informational session that you want to share.
Yes. First off, I would say for the record, the cream puffs were actually at the Wisconsin Center. And I think they were a hit. They were as tough to eat as cream puffs
as they always are.
Anywhere, right? But there were breakout sessions. Some of the sessions were off the record on security and delegate selection. You know, there were a few sessions that were on the record. Seemingly the most important one was the Battleground Wisconsin, basically Democrats showing how they were going to try to win Wisconsin and what some of their reasoning was for having the convention here. DNC Battleground Director David Bergstein presented about basically using the convention as an organizing opportunity for the party.
We're going to be able to reach voters in key markets. Certainly, conventions always have a terrific amount of media saturation, but there's nothing like having it in your own backyard. So we are very confident that we're going to be able to use this convention to reach voters in some of the most important areas of one of the most important states.
So what else did you learn during these sessions?
So, yeah, some of the important takeaways, Democrats say they're working on turnout. Like, there were potentially 41,000 voters in Milwaukee that didn't turn out in 2016 as it compared to 2012. So turnout in key areas like Milwaukee is important for them. Persuasion of voters who may be otherwise voting Republican, those are both key components for them. And harnessing the energy that the convention is going to have in the city. They also said that one of the main reasons they chose Milwaukee and Wisconsin is because they want to highlight Wisconsin stories. They say it's a good source for stories about President Trump's what they call broken promises, and they're really trying to highlight farm bankruptcies, dairy farmers, or trying to highlight people that have trouble with health care. So that's a key guiding post for the Democrats.
You know, as you say, I think a lot of people have seen the DNC's decision to come to Milwaukee as a sign that the Democratic Party is really trying to court voters here in Wisconsin in general. What did you learn about the Democrats' priorities moving forward in this election season, specifically here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Joy, because I think a lot of people, you know, who aren't political operatives are like, yeah, the Democratic Party has one fight, and that fight is to defeat President Trump. But actually, what was interesting in this breakout session is they outlined four other fights that they have. And one of those is to galvanize the volunteers who, you know, are ready to participate as volunteers in the DNC, and to also make sure that they are active in volunteering for fall elections as well. Another fight that they have are the spring elections. You know, that's something that's huge that's coming up this year. There's seats on the Supreme Court that are open for that. And one thing that they're also looking at is to organize for the future. So one example that they brought up is Ron Johnson's seat that will be available in 2022.
So their eye is really on the prize, not just looking at 2020, but really out into the future as well.
Yeah,
yes.
and the supermajority that the Republicans could potentially get in the legislature if they get three more seats, and then they could override Governor Evers' vetoes. So that's something the Democrats are really focusing on.
So I think all, in that breakout session, they outlined five major battles that they have as their priorities moving forward.
So I was interested to learn that the Trump administration, or the Trump campaign more specifically, actually responded to the walkthrough. What did they have to say?
Yeah, so the Trump campaign issued a statement in response to the walkthrough. They were criticizing Democratic policies like Medicaid for all, health care, eliminating border walls, and fossil fuels is what their position is. And in a statement, they said that the Democrats' flashy media tour cannot hide that their radical policy proposals are wrong for Wisconsin. So they ended with some confidence that, you know, Wisconsin voters decided for Trump in 2016, and they're going to give those 10 Electoral College votes to Trump again in 2020. You know, Wisconsin is a purple state. It's a battleground state. It's a state where elections have been decided by a small number of voters. And so, you know, the Democrats are hoping that this convention here will kind of tip the scale.
When you spoke to a national reporter, David Mark, on whether he thinks having the convention in a city will actually sway voters there, let's hear a bit of that.
I've heard this so many times from both parties. Like, the Republicans tried this in 2008 with Minnesota, neighboring state here.
There was one in Cleveland, right? A Republican?
Right. Republicans did win Ohio by a large margin. How much that can be attributed to actually holding a convention there is another question.
So ultimately, in your experience with conventions, it's not necessarily a persuading factor?
There's not a whole lot of evidence. Sometimes they're held for other reasons, for messaging reasons. In this case, though, clearly there's serious organization going on here, being built up by Democrats. So maybe they know something that the rest of us don't. And there's reason to think by just having Democrats camp out here, that in and of itself will help out.
David Mark was also really interested in Governor Evers' comments at the beginning of the Tuesday events that there would be many candidates in the race at the point of the convention in July. And Joy, I think this is something that would interest you because, you know, that could happen if there are splits in primaries and caucuses and multiple candidates being chosen by the different places. And so ultimately, it could be a brokered convention is kind of what Evers was implying. What do you think about that?
A brokered convention? I think it will mean a lot of congestion. Above all.
Yes,
see
yes.
What you did there.
Yes, yes, exactly.
So, of course, the Democratic National Convention, it's about much more than politics. Obviously, for us here in Milwaukee, many people are going, what is the bus going to be like? What are the roads going to be like? It's also, though, a chance for Milwaukee to make a big impression on the national stage. So what kind of information was there about the city for reporters, specifically national reporters?
Yeah, that's a great question, Joy. I read somewhere that Milwaukee is going to be in 2020 one of the most showcased cities in the nation. And I think that, you know, the DNC and city officials are really trying to capitalize on all of that media attention because, yeah, as you mentioned, this wasn't just politics. This was like, hey, jump on a bus tour with Rocky Marcou, who is the city of Milwaukee's development commissioner, and take a tour of the city. And this was a pretty detailed, in-depth, 90-minute city tour. We started at the Wisconsin Center and snaked through downtown, passing historical landmarks like the Iron Block Building and City Hall. But we also touched a bit on the South Side. We crossed over the South Street Bridge and we went down Fifth Street, where I'm sure you'll find this interesting. I didn't know this, but according to Marcou, there's apparently been 17 new businesses that have cropped up in the area just within the past 5 years. And this is also really fascinating. He attributed a lot of that growth to something called street dieting, where it's essentially they've narrowed the street to just two lanes so you have less traffic going through the street and you widen the sidewalk so that you can increase the flow of pedestrians. And so that was really fascinating. That was a really interesting point for a lot of members of the media. But I would say that the main emphasis overall was redevelopment, redevelopment, redevelopment. And that's something that radio reporter from Washington, D.C., John Stolness, found particularly interesting.
It's nice to kind of come someplace with an open mind. And it was really enlightening, the history of the city and different people who have gotten their start here, the industry and all that. And I had no idea the revitalization process that's gone on over the last 20 years.
Of course, it wasn't all rose-colored glasses. Marcou also touched on the pockets of poverty and economic disparity that exist in Milwaukee, explicitly stating that segregation is a major problem in this city. And just to give you an example of how that kind of played out on the tour is that as we passed by Red Arrow Park in downtown Milwaukee, Marcou did mention, you know, the skating rink. It's a popular hotspot in front of Starbucks. It's, you know, comparable to, you know, Central Park. But he also stated that, hey, that's where Dontre Hamilton, an unarmed black man, died at the hands of Milwaukee police.
Part of the Black Lives Matters movement was fueled with what happened here in Milwaukee. And it's an ongoing issue in terms of our police community relations.
On the bus with us was also Mark Page, who was visiting from a media company in Dallas. And Mayan, I know that you spoke to him about what he thought about the tour.
Yeah, I talked to him after he got off the bus. He was actually really pretty impressed. And one of the things that struck him the most was the emphasis and what he learned about the city's black history.
I didn't know that this was a stop on the Underground Railroad. That's huge. I didn't know that there was a man here that was survived the lynching that then fought for civil rights all of his life and created a museum, a black Holocaust museum. Didn't know that.
So Page was struck by that. He was struck by the UCC, which was pointed out on the tour, the United Community Center that serves the Hispanic community on the South Side. He was impressed with some of the economic development that's happened, and he said that a city's richness is not necessarily based on money, but also this sort of cultural richness and this people coming together, and he was really impressed. He even said he might even be willing to move here, literally.
No.
Wow. He did. He said that. He did
from
say
Dallas.
That. Yes, yes,
and
he did.
And he's a native of San Francisco,
he's
right?
He's a native of San Francisco, and he said San Francisco, this is how impressive the bus tour was. He said San Francisco has something to learn from Milwaukee. Page said all he knew about Milwaukee before he came here was that it's cold, it's got cold weather, people like to drink beer, and we've got a pretty good basketball team, the Bucks. That's what he knew, but he said he didn't know why the DNC chose to have the convention here.
And after this tour, after this visit, I know why. You guys are you're trying to progress and bring people together for the right reasons, And this is a state that needs to get out and vote. And this is a place that is rich with opportunity that can drive the rest of the country.
I think he's saying a lot of what we've heard from politicians and people in the media in general, that this is a city, but it's also a state that is a big deciding factor in this election. And it's perhaps unsurprising then that the DNC will be here, but a good surprise for us.
Yes, and time will tell whether or not, you know, whether it plays out as something that makes a difference and if it unfolds as seamlessly as these past 2 days of receptions and cream puffs and sessions have come out.
Absolutely. I think as local reporters, you know, one thing that's really interesting for us is to see exactly how the national media is going to paint Milwaukee. What is the image? What is the story that's going to be told about Milwaukee in the lead up to the DNC? So it'll be interesting to see.
Yeah. Well, Mayan, Angelina, thank you both so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and speaking with me about the DNC.
Excellent. Thank you, Joy.
Our pleasure.
Mayan Silver and Angelina Mosier-Salazar are both reporters for WUWM. They spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. You can find more of our coverage of the 2020 Democratic National Convention at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll talk with Carol Nixon and Chris Drosner about Milwaukee Magazine's Winter Playbook, offering some very cool ways to keep your spirits up in the cold weather. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. We are back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. There's no way around it. Winter in Wisconsin can be rough. The snow and ice coupled with gray skies and frigid winds can make surviving the season a Herculean task. But Milwaukee Magazine has come up with a list of more than 50 ways to make your winter a lot brighter. The feature is aptly titled Your Winter Playbook, and it was edited by Carol Nixon and Chris Drosner. They joined me and Lake Effect's Joy Powers in the studio to talk about the piece.
Carol, Chris, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Yeah, it's great to have you, and we're going to double team you today.
We're excited about
yeah?
that.
Yeah? Is that good?
We've never done it before.
I know. It's very exciting. And this is all about how to get through winter.
Yes.
Essentially, it's the winter playbook.
It is.
And so I have the first question,
okay.
Which is, you know, we hear every year about ways to make sure we don't get depressed during the long, dark days of winter. And so what are some of them that you highlight in this issue that some of that we may not have heard of?
Well, I think some of the most fun ideas are just these little quick things that you can do to lift your spirits. Like, for instance, smile more. And it seems that if you smile more, it will have an effect on your overall disposition. And even, now this is the part that really got me, people who've had Botox and are less able to frown report better moods. So, I mean, if I have to do the Botox to be in a better mood, I will do that.
You didn't do that for this issue?
I haven't
just
yet,
to try
but
it?
I will.
Okay.
I'm going to.
All right. And have you, obviously not the Botox, but have either of you tried any of these other things to see how they go?
Well, I tried to kick social media, but I didn't quite make it. I mean, that was another thing that we kind of highlighted was even if you don't cut it off, maybe tone it down a little bit, you know, turn off the notifications, that sort of thing. And that, you know, getting away from that kind of addictive personality thing kind of helps you live in the moment. And even if the moment is a little chilly and dark, but it's another stressor on your life. And I mean, social media brings a lot of positive things too, but it can it can be pretty dreary.
One of the most exciting tips, I think, in that section is about adding an extension to your browser so that any picture of Trump is turned into a kitten, and it's called Make America Kittens Again. And, I mean, I think that's worth the price of the magazine in and of itself.
Make America Kittens Again. Yeah. I mean, that is something that I think stresses out a lot of people on social media, just the bombardment of news. But there are some other things that you talked about. And as you mentioned, in our industry especially, it's incredibly difficult to get off of social media. But if you are someone who is trying to kick the habit, what are some of the tips that you've laid out here?
One of them is resist the impulse to document everything for Instagram. I mean, it's really just sort of separating yourself from all of those things that have become habitual in our lives. Compulsive checking. I mean, I think that that's a real straightforward and easy method to just spend less time on your phone. Just make a rule like once an hour or whatever works for you, but just resist the constant impulse that every time you have a spare second, you're going to pull your phone out.
I mentioned turning off notifications, which is something that I did successfully with one of the apps. I just disabled Facebook notifications because, like, I don't really care. And I find that I do check it less, and it's you know, you look at that screen how many times a day? Like, dozens. And if there's one less thing that says, hey, that's grabbing your attention, I think, you know, that's one more thing that's out in the real world that you can be focusing on instead.
I find that the hardest time for me to put it down is at night when I've kind of relaxed and everything. I'd have the television on. I might be reading or something like that. But I constantly find myself reaching for the darn phone to see if something happened that I need to check about. And it's like, oh, my God, put it down.
Anytime I have to wait for anything, that used to be time mm-hmm. where you would just – I don't even remember what it was like before this. But now it's – How I've got 30 seconds here that we can do something with this. And it's, man, it's a disease.
And I have a suggestion. You could read a magazine.
There you go.
You could read a magazine.
You could read a magazine.
I mean, it doesn't work at a stoplight, but yes.
You could.
Yes.
You could.
Absolutely.
Well, one of the things you also talk about in the issue is being more active, that's a way to keep your mood up and to hopefully keep your phone down, even if you're using it to track your miles or whatever. What are some of the new workouts that you try? Because I had not heard of any of those, and I thought they were kind of cool and thought, well, I might want to try that.
Yeah, a lot of the ones that – a lot of these are kind of focused on making them, like, maximizing the time that you get. So there's this one called F45, which has two offices in the metro area here, and it's like, so that the 45 is 45 minutes and the F is, I guess, full body, but it's this kind of aggressive cross training that does cardio and strength and you know, hybrid, kind of all these different things, bringing them together for one big workout.
And get it done and get it done fast.
Yep. Move on with your day. Yep.
Yep.
Now, Bonnie is very healthy and works out frequently. I am not this way. If you're somebody like me who maybe their New Year's resolution was, I need to start doing something. I need to get healthy again. What are some of the easier exercises that you have that you suggest for people during this time of the year?
Well, I think that, you know, one of the ways to survive winter just in general is to develop a hobby that makes you want to go outside, because you can't spend the whole winter inside. So we have a flow chart to help you find the outdoor activity that's right for you. And for me, I'm going to try cross-country skiing. I've tried downhill. I know that's not for me. But cross-country, I think I could do that. And you can go up to Brown Deer Park and do it there. I hear the trails there are amazing. So we have a lot of suggestions along those lines.
I think you should skate, Joy.
You think I should skate?
I think so. You're
a
dancer.
You haven't seen me skating.
Well, so. You're a dancer. You have that background.
Now, wait, are you saying ice skate or roller skate?
Ooh, because you have both.
Oh, we do.
Yeah.
And one of the things I'm really excited about is there's this thing called JB style skating. It originated in Chicago, and it means James Brown style. So people get out there on the rink and do these crazy moves. Now, again, I don't think it's for me, but I do want to see it, so I'm going to go check it out.
Can you just go and skate and not have to do the crazy moves?
I think so. I mean, so
you're not required to do the James Brown dance moves.
No, I mean, or maybe you could do them, you know, on the sidelines before you get on the skates, and then get on the skates and just try and stay up without falling.
That's always the trick.
And that's at Butler Skateland, and they have adult nights on Sundays and Wednesdays.
It's interesting that we're talking about skating because that's something that my boyfriend loves to do. He used to play hockey, and he's very big into ice skating, and we've gone roller skating together. And something inside of the winter playbook is a number of getaways, if you're a couple, things to do during the winter to maybe get you out of your normal routine.
Besides skating.
Besides skating. What are some of your suggestions?
One that's close to my heart as a former resident of this city is a trip over to Madison to do ice skating, actually, on the rink at the Edgewater Hotel downtown. It's right on Lake Mendota, and, you know, so you get the lake views and the city views behind you, and it's a pretty beautiful hotel, just recently redone, very... If you're going to stay the night, obviously it could be a day trip too. But it's very close to all the dining and drinking things in downtown Madison, and is just a beautiful, beautiful spot.
So one of the things that really intrigued me was the train.
Yes.
How cool is that?
I really would love to do this. It's the Wisconsin Great Northern Railroad, and it bills itself as America's only moving bed and breakfast train. So you get to be on this train, have an elaborate meal, spend the night. I just can't think of anything better.
And you get breakfast in the morning.
Yes.
Now, where does it go? Do we know?
It's up north, northwestern Wisconsin. So it's out of Spooner. I mean, that's beautiful country up there.
And so is it like out and back? It just kind of goes,
it must travel,
or maybe do a loop or something.
I think
How very cool. Yeah.
So if you're hoping to stay closer to home and you might have your kids with you, you've listed a number of different places where you can go with the kids, places that aren't just child-friendly, they're also adult-friendly.
One of the pieces that we did here was, and we kind of developed the angle by chance because somebody in our office actually took her daughter for, it was her 12th birthday party. So instead of having a party, they got a room at the Great Wolf. And I was thinking, like, oh, the Great Wolf in, you know, in the Dells. And she said, no, the one in Gurnee in just north of Chicago is quite a bit closer. And I'm like, I kind of did the math. I'm like, yeah, I guess it is. So, and you know, those water parks, they're so, like, kind of just wet and steamy and warm. And, like, it's a good kind of escape from that cold, dry stuff that we were just talking about.
I don't think this is just for kids. One of our editors, she's in her 20s, and she goes every year with a bunch of girlfriends, and I tried to get myself invited. She's thinking about it. I don't know.
I mean, who doesn't like water slides?
I know.
That's universal.
I would like it.
Yeah.
You want to go?
Sure. Let's do it.
Yeah. Let's do it.
Okay. It's the Lake Effect Milwaukee Magazine road trip.
Yes.
Done.
Yes.
All right. Yes. Nobody will be depressed.
No, we'll be smiling with our
Botox.
We'll
be smiling.
You know, one other thing that, and this is probably for a little bit older families that my wife actually saw the story and asked about it and was like, that sounds so cool, is this game show Battle Room. It's up in Brookfield, and it's basically like you get to do, I think they have like kind of knockoff names like Friendly Feud, and because you can't call it Family Feud, or Wheel of Phrases and Name That Price. I realize my air quotes are not translating well to the radio here, but but you get to, you know, bring your whole gang there, and I think you can do up to 32 people. So, I mean, obviously this is a bigger group thing, but it can be smaller too. And you get like a host who runs the game for you, and that sounds like a lot of fun.
I think it sounds fun too. And with all of these ideas, I don't care how long winter lasts. It can go on forever. We've got so many things
Carol,
to do.
No. Let's not get crazy
here. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Don't tempt the gods.
And you know it will anyway, so.
Yeah.
Now it will.
Yeah. Now, yeah. We've ruined it now.
The old jinx.
Well, Carol and Chris, thank you so much for sharing some of the. This is only a. We're just touching on some of the things that you've put in the magazine, but let's go out and not be depressed.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Carol Nixon is the publisher and editor-in-chief of Milwaukee Magazine. Chris Drosner is the magazine's executive editor. They spoke with me and Lake Effect's Joy Powers about this month's feature on how to make the most of winter. You can find a link to the article at WUWM.com. We will take one last break and then welcome Milwaukee author Nick Petrie back to the studio to talk about his latest book, The Wild One. You are listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Bonnie North. It's January, and that means one thing. Nick Petrie is releasing the newest book in his Peter Ashe series. The Wild One takes our intrepid protagonist, a Milwaukee native and veteran of the Iraq War who suffers from PTSD, far from his Wisconsin home and sets him up in an inhospitable yet beautiful place. Like in all of Petrie's books, the mystery Ashe is trying to solve is compelling, the characters sharply drawn, and the pace relentless. The Wild One will be released on January 14th with a launch at Boswell Book Company the night of the 13th. I'll be talking with Nick at Boswell that evening, but ahead of that, I asked him to come into the studio to give us a preview.
In The Wild One, Peter goes to Iceland to find a young boy whose mother has been murdered by the boy's father. So he's sent on sort of a mission of mercy, but when Peter gets off the plane in Reykjavik, a man from the U.S. Embassy, for reasons unknown and unofficial, wants Peter sent home. And so in order to find the boy and catch a killer, Peter has to outwit and outfight and outlast the Icelandic cops, the boy's Icelandic family, and the largest winter storm Iceland has seen in a generation.
Just to add one more thing
to
give him something else to fight against. And I have to say, he's doing this by himself. He's kind of on his own on this one.
He is. I every book I sort of give myself an assignment. And and part of the assignment for this one was to put Peter, is to really sort of isolate him and to make him as miserable as I possibly could. To see how deep he could dig and how much trouble he could get into and get out of.
Did he surprise you at all?
Yeah. This book was a very, it was a very interesting process in writing this book. I had never really planned to write anything set in Iceland. I got sort of talked into an Icelandic backpacking trip by my son about 2.5 years ago. And we went on this grand adventure. We went hiking across the Hornstrandir Nature Reserve, 5 days sort of crisscrossing, you know, from one side of the peninsula to the other. We got dropped off by a boat. We got picked up by a boat. There's no road access. It was this incredibly sort of isolated and beautiful and kind of scary place.
Sounds fantastic.
It was one of the peak experiences of my life was this trip with my son. But in the airport, waiting to get on our plane, the book sort of appeared in my head in all of a piece, which has never happened to me before. And I spent the next, you know, year and a half sort of trying to excavate it and turn it into a book.
I'm just trying to imagine like the entire book just sort of dropping into your head and then the process of trying to like remember all the pieces.
Well, so I got about 20 minutes of clarity where I really could see all the pieces, all the moving parts. The characters really all kind of showed up and I have a little notebook I carry with me everywhere I go and I scribbled as fast as I could, sort of trying to capture as much as I could, and then it disappeared again. It's like trying to reconstruct some lost document on the basis of the scrawlings of a madman.
In the middle of the Reykjavik airport.
Yes, in the middle of the Reykjavik airport. After 11 days of hiking and staying up all night, because we went during the summer when
there is no dark.
There really is no dark.
Yeah.
Which is a whole different thing.
Yeah, because the book is set in the winter where there is no light, essentially.
Right.
And you, what, have maybe 2 or 3 hours in the middle of the day?
Yeah, and it depends on the weather. If it's clear, you get more light. If it's overcast or the clouds are, you know, right above the top of your head, which often happens in Iceland, you know, it really kind of never gets light at all. So, and that was sort of part of the atmosphere I was trying to create. You know, this is every book I don't really know this at the time, but I'm trying to riff on something or another. I wrote a book set in Denver about the cannabis industry that turned out to be kind of a Western novel in a way. And this one is, you know, sort of half Private Eye novel and half sort of Scandinavian noir.
I was going to say Scandinavian noir thriller.
I'll take that.
Because it's got that feel. I feel like I'm, you know, in the middle of, you know, some sort of Swedish television show. Except it's Icelandic. But yeah, it's that sense. And one of the things I noticed, because of course you and I have talked about, I think, all of your books, and I've certainly read them all, I notice the way you talk about Iceland. It's another character.
Well, I'm really interested in place. And when you write a series, which is what I do, and you set it all in the same place, it has a certain kind of character. But every place has a set of strengths and a set of limitations. And one of the great pleasures of writing this series, which each book is set in a different location. And so you get to you know, really develop each setting as a character. And it both makes the books distinct from each other in a way that they wouldn't be necessarily if they were all set in Milwaukee, for example. But it helps me to direct the choices, to direct the story. So a story set in Memphis, which was my fourth book, is going to have a certain set of choices that are different from a story set in Iceland like this one.
Also, I couldn't help but think that the Iceland of my imagination, because I've not been there. It's on my bucket list. But the Iceland that I read about and the Iceland of my imagination mirrors Peter so well. There's like this sweeping dark with splashes of light and things happening and both cold and warm. And I thought, what a perfect place for him.
Well, it is, and it really pushes all of his buttons. It's especially in the wintertime, right? Peter has post-traumatic stress from his time in Iraq, and so he can't really be inside for very long. And in the winter in Iceland, you know, there's not a lot of outside to go to.
Not if you want to live.
Well, yeah, not if you want to be, you know, warm and above ground. And so, you know, again, it all kind of plays into, you know, giving Peter a set of challenges.
Well, and also giving him challenges that really test him. I mean, what I love about the sort of the arc and the sweep of the book is that he and Iceland kind of have some face-to-face chats, you know, more than once.
Yeah, there are some come to Jesus moments.
Yes. And
you know, when you're somebody like I'm an outdoors guy. I've been a backpacker for 30 plus years. I would always generally rather be outside. That's something that Peter and I really have in common. But you know, there's a certain intensity and a certain rawness when you are out on a mountain or in the middle of a wood somewhere that, you know, it really is just you. And that's sort of part of the character of Peter as well. And certainly in this book, where Peter does not have his friends to rely on, and in part that's kind of his fault, his own choice. People always say to me, "So now, why do you have to be so hard on poor Peter?" And you know, that's kind of my job is to torture, you know, my character, is to tell a more interesting story.
Well, and to have them grow into some interesting places,
right,
and figure out things about themselves. Yeah, and I, you know, there was a very big Lewis-shaped hole at the very beginning of it. I thought, wait, Lewis isn't here. But I found that as the story went on, I would have liked to have seen how he reacted to all of it, but I also didn't miss him. I felt like the story, it was okay that he was in California with his family during this whole thing, and that June wasn't there either, although she was in his head the whole time for various reasons. But that, yeah, that whole support system just, it was okay.
Well, when you're in the middle of the dark night of your soul, you know, it doesn't really matter, you know, who you're with, you're alone. And that's kind of part of what I was trying to do with Peter, was to, you know, kind of have him hit bottom in a fairly profound way.
Yeah, it was a really interesting, for me, character study of him. I mean, they're all character studies of him, but I got to know him in different ways, in deeper ways, in this book.
Well, I'm glad you feel that way, because that was part of the goal as well, is to sort of strip away, you know, all of the tricks I have given myself over the last books, and to have this sort of just be Peter, kind of out on his own. And it honestly scared the hell out of me, the idea of doing something so elemental, past the point where I turned it in and I was waiting to hear what my editor had to say, and I still really had no idea, what he was going to say.
And what did he say?
he said, "Wow." It was actually kind of an astonishing experience, because he was a stand-in. My editor was on maternity leave, my usual editor, and so this is my temporary editor was the guy who discovered Tom Clancy. So he's kind of a giant in the industry, and I got fewer notes from him on this book than I have for any other book. It was really just you know clean up a little here, do a little of this somewhere else. It just kind of boggled my mind, and I basically said, "So, you know, you're not just going easy on me because you just want to get this, you know, get this done with, so I can start the next one." And he's like, "No, if this needed work, you would know it." As a writer, it's always interesting because you spend so much time alone with the work, and at a certain point, you just can't see it anymore. You know, Margaret, my wife, reads parts of it. She'll often read the first big chunk to kind of say, "Okay, you're, you know, kind of on the right track." But really, nobody sees it until I send it off to my editor, and I'm holding my breath for a couple of weeks while I wait to hear.
Yeah, I bet. It's almost like this one was a dark night of the soul for you too.
A little bit, yeah. I had this spectacular mountain bike wipeout where I tore up my shoulder. I had to have surgery. The surgeon said that it was the kind of injury he generally sees with car accidents or hockey players. That
you really wiped out.
Oh no, I was moving fast.
It was a
very nice experience. But you know, and it kind of messed me up, and I was in bed for, you know, almost 2 weeks, and I told my agent, who is a certifiable piece of work, and her first words were, "Can you still type?"
Well, with one hand,
yeah, no,
maybe.
No pressure.
None at all.
So, you know, and it was a challenge. There were you know, some other things going on as well. So, you know, some books are easier than others, and this was one of the others.
But I think it was worth the slog through the Slough of Despond, if we can, mix our metaphors here.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting that there was a point where I said to myself, you know, do I want to keep going with this, or do I want to start something else? And I really kind of went back and looked at it, and I just thought, I really like this story. I love writing about Iceland. There's something that is so compelling to me about the landscape. It's so primal. I don't know. I'm so glad I didn't cave. I'm so glad I didn't let myself weasel out and kept going.
Well, and I love your Icelandic characters too. There are a number of different ones that we meet along the way. Some are part of the family of the little boy, and some not. I guess everyone's sort of related, kind of in some tangential way.
Well, in Iceland, everybody's sort of related as well.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean, that just because it's small.
Right.
And, you know, and somewhat self-contained. And so, but you captured that whole Nordic stoicism and just sort of practicality, but also just willingness to like throw it all out there and go when it's called for.
Well, it was actually one of the challenges was sort of, you know, when you don't, I don't speak Icelandic, and my experience there was limited. Duncan and I actually went twice, but it was still, you know, less than 3 weeks over the course of about 13 months. And it was hard to kind of figure out how to think about the Icelanders. And it really, when somebody said to me that Iceland is like the Wyoming of Europe, nobody recycles, there's all this open space, and that sort of helped, because I've known a lot of people who live in places like Wyoming who are you know, it's that self-reliance, and you're a little dwarfed by this gigantic, epic, ever-present landscape. And that really helped me, you know, sort of think about the people that I knew who had lived sort of, you know, on the last road, at the end of the last road. But it was so much fun to do, and this happens to me a lot, but, you know, some of these characters just kind of showed up. And it was like, oh, okay, so what do I do with this guy?
Who are you,
yeah,
and why are you here? Okay,
right.
I guess we'll figure that
right
out. Yeah. Well, in every book, there are always characters that I think, oh, I want to know what happened to that person, or I want to know the story of that person. You know, it's like I can see that if you were so inclined, you could write about that person, or you could write. And there were certainly a couple of people in this that I thought, you know, Bjarni was one, and I'm forgetting his name, the police captain.
Oh, Hjalmar.
Both of them. Both of them, and I thought they could each have their own series.
Well, that's such a, to me, that's a giant compliment, because that's, to me, is the goal, is that you can imagine these characters having a life of their own somewhere else. That I don't generally do book clubs because nobody actually reads the book in a book club, and it is my experience. But I did one for the first book, The Drifter, but years ago, and it was all women, and they had all read the book, and they all had very definite opinions about it. And at one point, I'm just sort of sitting in a chair watching, I don't know, 20 women argue about, well, Peter would do this or Peter would do that, and it was so wonderful to have this character have taken on sort of reality in the minds of these readers. So it was, you know, that is my goal in a way, and it's such a compliment to hear.
Well, I hope you do, because I kind of want to know what happens. I'm not going to give away the last time we see either of these guys, but they're in some interesting places, and I would love to. So maybe Peter goes back at some point.
Well, I'm wondering, at one point I get to go revisit some of the earlier characters. Mm-hmm. The thing about the series is there have so far really only been three recurring characters. There's Peter Ashe, his friend Lewis, and June Cassidy, who's his sweet patootie. And, you know, my goal is to sort of keep these books sort of lean and flexible so that I can go any place and write any kind of story I want to write. But at a certain point, it's fun for the reader, and it's also fun for me to kind of bring characters back to see, you know, where they are 3 years out or 5 years out. And you going back to read, you know, some of my favorite series, right? Robert Crace, the Elvis Cole, Joe Pike books are wonderful. And there are characters that come back, you know, every X number of books. Robert Parker did that as well in the Spencer novels, which are also some of my favorites.
Yeah, and it's a wonderful thing. It's like seeing an old friend. As
right,
for a reader,
right,
it's like, oh, hi, how are you?
Right.
You
right
know, where have you been? What have you been doing?
Right.
And it's fun to see how they can kind of reunite in a new way. And so,
Yeah, it's like seeing someone you haven't seen for, you know, an old high school friend that you meet 10 years later.
Right.
It is a challenge, though. I never thought this. I mean, I never thought that first book would get published. So here I am. You know, the fifth book is coming out. I'm working on the sixth book, and I'm still kind of scratching my head that this whole thing is happening. But you know, I never thought it would be a series, and now I'm you know, six books in, and trying to figure out what does it mean to write a series. You know, what does it look like? What's important to me? How do I want it to evolve? And if you look at, you know, I went back and thought about the series that had been really influential on me and the books that I had loved and had read over and over again. And there are so many different ways to write, you know, a long series of books. And it's a, you know, you kind of have to set a course and make some decisions. You know, do they age normally? Do they never age at all? You know, it's a hard, you know, given that I really had never thought about it at the beginning. It's an interesting challenge.
So, can you talk at all about where Peter is now, or are we going to wait until book six for that?
So it starts in Milwaukee. I can tell you that much because that's about as far as I am. And,
okay.
and I have a number of Milwaukee and Wisconsin readers who want to see Peter come back to Milwaukee. So there's the beginning right now. I should even tell you this because I don't know if it's going
to. It might not be.
It's going
right
to evolve.
But for right now,
it starts in the public market.
Perfect. Perfect.
There you go.
And then we'll get to talk to Lewis again too, right?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Because got to have Lewis.
No, Lewis is too much fun to leave out.
Well, Nick Petrie, as always, a great read. So wonderful to talk with you. And I look forward to chatting with you at Boswell on the 13th for the launch.
I'm very excited about that. Thank you so very much.
Milwaukee native Nick Petrie is the author of the very successful Peter Ash series. The Wild One, which is the newest edition, will be released on January 14th. You can hear Nick and me in conversation about the book the evening of January 13th at Boswell Book Company. There's more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North. It's a pleasure having you with us today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock now. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.